Hello, everybody. This is lecture four. Before I get into the lecture day, I wanted to tell you I was talking to my great friend, Father James Sadowski, today. I'm on the phone with him practically every day. He's a retired Jesuit. He's not in such good health now. He's 88. But he has very good comments on things. So I want to pass on to you two ways he has of answering arguments he doesn't like. We were discussing a particular argument. I won't go into what the argument was in detail, but I asked him what would happen if someone were to raise this point against what you're saying. And he said, "So what?" That's one you can remember to refute arguments. Another one he has is, if you raise a point against him, he'll say, "I don't think that's a very strong point, do you?" So if you remember those two, you'll have an easy way to answer arguments. Well, now, what we've been discussing so far in the course, we started off, we're talking about the old right, which is the group that Rothbard is sympathetic to, and Rothbard regards himself as having been part of the old right. And the old right, as we said, was not conservative in the sense of right wing, in the sense that European conservatism uses that term, namely to designate opponents of the French Revolution. On the contrary, the old right tended to be sympathetic to the free market and to libertarianism, and also to support a non-interventionist foreign policy. But during and after World War II, the old right's foreign policy views became unpopular, and while there were still, as we talked about last time, there were old right people such as Robert Taft who were opposed to the Korean War, and we had people such as Herbert Hoover who went further, and Taft also to an extent opposed the Cold War with Russia. There was a movement among American conservatives that strongly supported the Cold War, and the key magazine here, the key movement was the movement centered around the magazine National Review, which was founded by William Buckley in 1955. And you remember, I mentioned the last time, Buckley himself had a libertarian background. His father was a friend of Albert J. Nott, the great libertarian theorist who, remember, wrote Our Enemy, the State, was a follower of Franz Oppenheimer, the German sociologist, in viewing the state as a predatory body. That Nock and Oppenheimer distinguished between the economic means, which is a way people can better themselves by engaging in peaceful relations with others. People produce things and trade with one another. And then the state, which is the political means, where it's an organized force to take things from people who produce them. The state doesn't produce things by itself. It takes from those who do. So Nock's disciple Frank Chodorov held this libertarian view, and Buckley not only read Nock and was influenced by him, but he was a friend of Chodorov, and he was very much influenced by Chodorov. But he thought that during the Cold War, we're engaged in a life and death struggle with Soviet communism. So we had to put aside libertarian policies till the Cold War was over. It's something like imagine, say, somebody in the neighborhood is going to attack you, somebody's coming at you with a machine gun, and the only way you can defend yourself is to take a gun in your neighbor's backyard. So you take it, even though you haven't asked him for permission, you don't, because it's such an emergency, you don't have time to really observe the libertarian proprieties and ask him, can I use this gun? And what if he said no? Would you have to give up your life? So Buckley was saying, while the Cold War is going on, we have to suspend libertarianism to defeat communism. We really have to have drastic measures. Now, there was one writer in National Review, I'm not going to talk about him very much today, but interestingly, actually, Murray Rothbard knew him. I mentioned him before, he's a former member of the Communist Party named Frank Meyer. And Meyer thought, we don't have to make such a sacrifice. We can be libertarians and still favor a very aggressive Cold War policy. So Meyer said, in contrast to Buckley said we have to suspend libertarianism for the duration of the struggle with Russia. Meyer said, no, we don't have to do this. Meyer himself wrote a book called In Defense of Freedom, and he was pretty much what we would call in domestic domestic affairs, he was pretty much a minimal state libertarian, but he also favored a very aggressive Cold War strategy, even going to the lens of favoring preventive war against Soviet. So this, I think you can see, is a very unstable combination. It's something like saying, well, we can have a libertarian society after we blow up the world. So this didn't have much of a following, but there were some people on that who thought we could retain libertarianism and still follow the Cold War, pursue the Cold War very aggressively. But Meyer didn't have too much of a following. You can see there are inherent weaknesses in his position, that if you have that very aggressive foreign policy, you're not going to be able to follow libertarian principles very much, even in domestic affairs. To that extent, Buckley was right. I think that the Cold War does put a lot of pressure on people who want to be libertarians, if you favor aggressively pursuing the Cold War, that is. Now, what I want to talk about today, we're going to talk about two very important theorists who wrote for National Review, James Burnham and Wilmore Kendall. And what's significant about them is, in contrast to Buckley, who was saying something like, well, I'm really an old rightist myself, but just the present emergency, Cold War, means we have to put this aside. Burnham and Kendall, who were senior editors of National Review, did not claim to be libertarians in theory. They had very different political outlooks. They didn't have the same political outlook, but neither of them had a libertarian point of view. And both of them had worked at one time for the CIA. Burnham worked during World War II for the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was an intelligence agency under Colonel William Donovan, I think his name was, and that was a predecessor of the CIA, and continued as a consultant for the CIA. And Kendall also, I think, worked for the OSS and the CIA as well. So these were both had CIA connections. Burnham, who lived from 1905 to 1987, was the most influential writer on foreign policy for National Review. And in fact, he was really regarded as the major intellectual figure in the magazine, not just on foreign policy, although that was his principal area of specialty. But Buckley looked up to him as a really major intellect. This was, remember, when Buckley started National Review, remember, Buckley was born in 1926, I think, and he founded National Review in 1955, so he was a comparatively young person. So he looked up to Burnham and other people like Kendall and other writers as he needed to get his ideas from people. Buckley himself wasn't a major intellectual theorist. He was a very intelligent person, but he wasn't a theorist himself. So he had to look up to these people, and Burnham was the main person who influenced him on foreign policy. Burnham was, by profession, a philosophy professor. He'd been, before he entered the OSS in World War II, he'd been a professor at NYU, New York University, and he wrote an influential textbook with Philip Wheelwright, who was another professor there who was a specialist mainly in aesthetics and also wrote on Greek philosophy. They wrote a textbook called An Introduction to Philosophical Analysis. Now, besides his career as a philosophy professor, Burnham had a very interesting background. During the 1930s, he was associated with the Socialist Workers' Party, a Trotskyite group. Now, remember, after Lenin's death in the Soviet Union, Joseph Stalin took over as the first secretary of the Communist Party, and eventually became the holder of absolute power in Russia. But Trotsky had been a very influential figure in the Russian Revolution. He'd been really the main organizer of the communist side in the Russian Civil War, and he was considered the main, one of the main intellectuals who was supporting communism. He started off as a Menshevik, an opponent of the Bolsheviks, but he shifted and then supported Lenin, and he criticized Stalin, and the Trotskyites criticized Stalin's policy. Stalin would say, said, we have to build socialism in one country, namely Russia. We're not giving up on the idea of having revolutions in countries, especially in Europe, to establish communism everywhere. At least for now, Russia's weak, and we have to concentrate on building up Russia. So Trotsky said Stalin's putting too much emphasis on building socialism in one country, and he thought, also he didn't agree with the way Stalin's economic policies. He favored kind of Stalin was really making a lot of mistakes. However, although Trotsky had a very low opinion of Stalin and thought he made a lot of mistakes, he still thought that the Soviet Union was a socialist country. He said they're making a lot of mistakes, but after all, they're still socialists. And when Germany invaded the Soviet Union June 22nd, 1941, Trotsky favored support for the Soviet. Now, Burnham knew Trotsky personally, but he disagreed with Trotsky because Burnham said the Soviet Union really isn't socialist anymore. It's really become new kind of system that's really neither capitalist nor socialist. And so there was a big falling out between them, and Trotsky group expelled Burnham because he deviated from Trotsky's line. Now, as we'll see, when Burnham said that the Soviet Union wasn't really socialist anymore, that wasn't intended as a criticism of the Soviets. He wasn't saying, look, Soviets are bad because they're deviating from socialist orthodoxy. He was just saying more that socialism, as Marx had formulated, is really passé. We're coming on, we're getting something new. And he wasn't against that. We'll get into that very soon in the lecture. But before I get into what he thought about the new society, we have to understand what Burnham was saying. We need to grasp what I think is the key principle of his entire way of thinking. And this can be found in a book he wrote in 1943, which is called The New Machiavellians. This is the study of Machiavelli and some 19th and 20th century figures like Goffredo Pareto, Gaetano Mosca, Georges Sorel. So what Burnham does here, he begins by contrasting Dante, the great poet, with Machiavelli. And Dante, in his book De Monarchia, of Monarchy, pictures has a kind of utopian ideal. He said peace would be established in Europe if Europe were to be united under the emperor. And by the emperor, he means the holder of the empire, the Holy Roman Empire. Now, sometimes, incidentally, people will refer to the Holy Roman Emperor, not just the Holy Roman Empire, but you rarely find the emperors referred to that way, actually. This is just a sign. They'll either be called the emperor or the Roman Emperor, but they don't actually use the term Holy Roman Emperor, but you'll see that in a lot of books that have that. But anyway, Dante thought it would be really nice to have a peaceful world unified under the emperor, but he didn't have any idea of how to achieve this. He just thought, well, people will realize this is a great idea, and then they'll go ahead and try to establish it. But Burnham contrasts this with Machiavelli, who he thinks is a very realistic analyst of power. Now, Machiavelli favored Italian unification. Remember, at that time, Italy consisted of a number of different kingdoms and dukedoms and independent city-states, and they'd been doing very badly after France invaded Italy in 1494. So Machiavelli said, well, it would be a good thing if Italy could be unified and be able to repel the French invasion, become a significant power. But he didn't just say, well, I think this would be a nice thing. He considered what would be needed to achieve this. And more generally, he had a lot of things to say in The Prince and Discourses on Livy on how to gain and keep power. So what Burnham is saying, well, look, we have on the one hand, we have Dante, who has these unrealistic utopian ideas, and he's to be contrasted with Machiavelli, who's a realistic person who understands the realities of power. So what Dante's failing is, and Burnham sees this as, of course, something not just a failing, not peculiar to Dante, but found in all sorts of other thinkers. And he would find this in Aquinas, in Kant, in Locke, and I'm sure he'd apply this to libertarianism and all, he'd certainly apply it to Rothbard. He'd say, people in this unrealistic frame of mind will ask, like Donji will ask, what is the way the world ought to be? I'll say, what does morality require us to have? What should we do? And he says, Dante does not say, what does reality indicate the world is going to be? So let's just see how this would apply to libertarianism. Say, if you look at Rothbard, he said, well, you start off with the self-ownership principle, then you get Lockean property acquisition, and we can have people setting up protection agencies. So what Rothbard is doing is saying, here is how what morality requires us to do. But Burnham would say, well, look, you can say that all he wants, but that isn't telling us, is libertarianism going to happen? Is the libertarian society in line with the trends of history? So when he had this rather deprecating view of the role of ideas, and especially ideas of morality on history, he was influenced by these thinkers I mentioned, Pareto and Moskowitz, Italian thinkers, who thought that ideas are just ideological reflections of people's interests. What's really happening is people have conflicting interests, and then they'll just come up with ideas that'll make them look good. But these theories that they come up with or ideas really lack significance in their own right. We have to look at what the realities of interest, and particularly the struggle for power, and not think about what morality requires and what reason requires of the world, because reason and morality really aren't independent forces. I remember I mentioned Burnham was a philosophy professor, and in this rather critical view of the importance of morality, he was influenced by the logical positivist movement in philosophy, which was very influential in the 1930s and 40s and 50s as well. Now, writers like A.J. Ayer and Charles Stevenson and others said that judgments of morality aren't regular propositions with a truth value. For example, suppose I say it's raw taxation is wrong, it's a form of slave labor. According to the logical positivist, I'm not making a statement that can be evaluated as either true or false. If I said something like the tax rate under Franklin Roosevelt on certain kinds of income was over 90%, that would be a statement that's true, or it can be evaluated as true or false. But according to the positivist, these logical positivists, judgments of morality aren't like that. They're either statements or expressions of approval. For example, if I say taxation is a type of slave labor, I'm really expressing disapproval of taxation. I'm saying I don't like taxation. So why would I want to do that? Well, that's by expressing my dislike, I'm trying to persuade other people to go along with me. If I say taxation is a form of slave labor, I'm trying to get other people to oppose taxation, to try to get rid of taxation. But It isn't that we're making factual judgment. Now, you can see this view would tend to go along with theories that say morality isn't an independent force. You wouldn't have to. I mean, somebody could have the view, well, moral judgments don't have truth value in the ordinary sense. They're not true or false. Somebody could say, well, maybe people's expressions of preference are extremely important. But even though that's a logical possibility, people who took this view kind of said that principles of morality aren't really true or false. It would tend to go along with a theory of history that downplayed morality. And regardless of the logical connection there, it was certainly true with Burnham. Burnham could use this logical positivist view as a way of supporting his claim that morality wasn't really something, an independent force. He said, well, this is just people's emotional reactions to think what's really important in history is their interest, particularly their interest in gaining power. So, as I said, if morality and ideas in general don't determine history, we have to question, well, what does determine history? And Burnham, as I suggested already, answered, it's really the struggle for power is the primary factor in history. Struggle for power to control a particular state, and once, say, group has gotten control of a state, then the struggle between states, one trying to achieve power over other states. And Burnham explained his theory of the struggle of power in his most famous book, which is called The Managerial Revolution, which appeared in 1941. And what he was trying to do there was to apply his view of the struggle for power to try to explain the coming course of history. He was saying, Burnham was saying, I can foretell what's going to happen from now, mainly 1941, what will be the course of history in future, what will be how future events will develop. So what kind of important thing to realize in trying to understand Burnham is just his point that he believed he could foretell history, not in the sense, of course, that he was looking in a crystal ball, but he thought, just as the Marxists do, remember he had been a Marxist, he was a father of Trotsky, the Marxists say there's an inevitable trend in history that will lead to a socialist revolution. So Burnham stopped believing a socialist revolution, but he still held that history was really, had followed a deterministic pattern, and if you understood what the key causal factors in history were, you could tell what was going to happen. Now, critics of Burnham, like the great English writer George Orwell, noted that what Burnham did was he would tend to portray what he wanted as an inevitable trend instead of saying something like, I want a certain kind of society, namely one where there's this new ruling class will be in control. Instead of saying that, he would say, it isn't a matter of whether I want it or not, it's just we're inevitably going to have this new type of society. So, of course, Burnham wasn't the only person who did that, but he was certainly a practitioner of this kind of reason where you say what you want is the way history is going. Now, in Marxism, as you recall, if you study Marx, that Marx held what he called the forces of production by which Marx meant the technological developments of time are the real moving force of history, and that the relations of production, the way societies organized in classes to produce goods and services, really depends on the nature of technology. Now, as I say, Burnham abandoned Marxist socialism, but he still thought that technological developments determine how history was going. And he thought that as technology was developing, the system of capitalism based on individual ownership of businesses was really coming to an end. And there'd be a new ruling class, which would be composed of corporation managers, engineers, scientists, and government bureaucrats. So he's saying, well, the entrepreneurs of the 19th century aren't as significant as they were before. Now we're going to have this new group that will be taking over. And in talking about corporation managers, he was influenced by a book that came out in, I think, 1931 or 1932 by Adolph Burley and Gardner Means, which was The Modern Corporation and Private Property. And what Burley and Means argued was that in modern corporations, where there are corporations are owned by a whole lot of stockholders, there usually isn't one group of stockholders who owns the majority of the stock. There'll be a whole lot of different stockholders. And they thought in those circumstances, then the stockholders, even though they're the legal owners of the firm, really aren't running it. Really, the manager, the board of directors and the people the board of directors appoints as the president or CEO or other executives are really the ones who are running the corporation. So what they said in brief, it's a famous thing, they said there's a separation of ownership and control in the modern corporation. Now, just as a sideline, I think it's worth mentioning that Mises rejects this view. He says, and Rothbard, of course, also, Mises and Rothbard say, well, even if you don't have a majority stockholder, still the stockholders, if they don't like the way the managers are running things, they can just shift their investments to other stocks. So they're really able to control what the manager is doing simply by shifting their stock in different ways, if managers get their disapproval, of course, buying the stock if managers are doing things the way they want. But Burnham thought, because he accepted this thesis of separation of ownership and control, he thought that a new system, neither capitalism nor socialism, would come to prevail, and it would resemble fascism. Remember, in a fascist system, as Mises points out, you don't have government directly owning the means of production. Say, it isn't that you still have people who are called private owners, but they're really taking orders from the government. The government is telling them what prices to charge, what to invest. Even though there's ostensible private ownership, the private owners are really under the government control. This is characteristic fascist type of policy. It's really a variety of socialism. It's not ordinary sort of standard Marxist socialism, but it's still kind of a form of socialism. So Burnham thought this would be the system that would come to prevail. And actually, if you look at what he says, this type of society he's describing is very similar, say, to what Garrett Garrett and John T. Flynn thought was coming under Roosevelt. They thought there was this kind of American fascism developing. Of course, the difference was that Flynn and Garrett were opposed to this. They would say, isn't this terrible? Roosevelt's trying to replace our American system of individualism with this fascist system where the government is militarized and taking control of the economy. And Burnham said, well, this kind of system is coming, but he was all in favor of it. Now, it's true, as I mentioned before, that Burnham said he was not either favoring or opposing the system. He would think his personal views of whether this is good or bad really don't matter. What's important is what's actually happening. But even though he said this, George Orwell's thought, and I think he's clearly right about this, you can look at Orwell's article on Burnham, which is on the reading list. Orwell said, it's pretty clear if you read the book, Burnham likes what the system's describing. He's not saying, isn't it too bad that we don't have individualism anymore? He's saying, isn't this a great thing we're having this new system that's coping with, that's able to handle these tremendous new technological developments? Now, during World War II, Burnham became convinced that the U.S. and the Soviets would be engaged in a struggle for world power. And remember, he thinks that history is really determined by the struggle for power. And he favored, since he was a supporter of the U.S. side, he favored a preventive nuclear war if needed to win the struggle. He thought, especially for a while, only the U.S. had the atomic bomb until 1949, so he thought, well, wouldn't this be a good chance we could force the Soviets to do what we want? If they don't agree, we just drop a few A-bombs on them. And I'm sure many of you read Orwell's novel, 1984, and remember, in that novel, there's a struggle between three groups of states, Eurasia, East Asia, and Oceania. They're really not that different in their policies, but they're always involved in struggles with each other. So it would appear that Orwell, in portraying this struggle, was influenced by Burnham's managerial revolution. He was intending, of course, to be very negative about Burnham's thesis, but Burnham thought there'd be this struggle between various groups of states, and it's quite similar to what Orwell put in his novel. Now, there's a problem for Burnham, I want to suggest. He obviously wanted the U.S. to win the Cold War, but the problem for him is, on his own theory of power, why should he care so much? Because, couldn't we say, well, the systems in America and Russia are essentially the same, according to the managerial revolution. They're both neither old-fashioned communism nor socialism. They're kind of managerial system akin to fascism. So why should we care very much what happens, whether it's the U.S. or the Soviets that come to prevail? And I think we can answer this problem if we look at the 1943 book, The New Machiavellians. And what Burnham says there, again, he's considering things just from the point of view of what will promote the growth of power. He thinks that a system that allows some civil liberties and democracy might be better than one that doesn't. Says, well, if you have a system like in Stalin had, where there's a total suppression of personal liberty, that'll generate certain weaknesses in that regime. The people, of course, Russia did do very well in the Second World War, but the system eventually collapsed. So Burns saying, look, if you're just interested in preserving power, then maybe you should have some civil liberties and some democracy. And this was in accord with his own preferences, even though he's thinking that preferences, morality, really don't determine history. That's not to say Burnham didn't have preferences. So that was why he favored the U.S. over the Soviets. And of course, though, even though there is some, he favors some civil liberties and democracy, in his view, the people will never really rule. It's always elites pursuing power that are in control. But the issue is, should you at least allow some role for the people, say, to express their grievances or to have some influence? You would never have a system where the people are in control. That just wouldn't be right. Now, as Burnham got older, associated with National Review, remember what I've been saying so far is Burnham had a lot of influence on Buckley, but also as Burnham continued on at National Review, he became more politically conservative, and he was influenced by various people who wrote for National Review, and he became more attached to the traditional way of life than he'd expressed in his previous work. For example, if you look at his book, Congress and the American Tradition, which came out in 1959, he favors a strong role for Congress, even though you'd expect from his view of the managerial revolution, he would think that Congress, which very often expresses local interests, and at that time, much of Congress was dominated by rural interests, remember, until the decision in the 1960s, the rural interests were very heavily overrepresented in Congress. So you would expect somebody who supports managerial revolutions, they would have to have this new modern technological society, be opposed to a strong role for Congress, but Burnham wasn't. So as I say, the tension here in Burnham's theory, in that he wants a place for Congress, even though his own theory of the managerial revolution seems to go against this. So he likes the old America, which is one of individual enterprise, and but even though his theory says this is doomed, he still likes it. And there is a movement in American conservatism, we're not going to be talking about it in this course very much, but I'll just mention, we're going to be talking in the lecture next week and the one after that about the neoconservatives. There is a group opposed to the neoconservatives called the paleoconservatives. And one of the leading paleoconservatives was a writer named Sam Francis, whom I knew, and he was Burnham's leading disciple. So you'll find, if those of you are interested in Sam Francis' idea, this is a problem for him. He was saying, isn't Burnham a great thinker? But on at the same time, he was saying, we've got to oppose these elite groups that are trying to control us and set aside traditional American values. But Burnham would seem to have not much place for the traditional American values that he liked. And I think this was a problem for Sam Francis also. Now, despite his coming to have high regard for the American tradition, Burnham never abandoned his belief that power is primary and ideas secondary. In his last important book, there were some books after this, with mostly collections of his columns for National Review, it was called Suicide of the West, which came out in 1964. He argues that liberalism is the ideology of American suicide. And by liberalism, he meant the contemporary left, not classical liberalism. But even though he meant the contemporary left, he included certain beliefs that classical liberals would have as examples of suicidal belief. For example, supposing you believe that people have the same rights regardless of where they live, like everyone has the right of self-ownership, that would be a libertarian principle. Or suppose you're opposed to torture, you say, regardless of whether you can get information out of people through torture, people ought not to be subject to torture. This is a violation of human dignity. Burns said, well, those are just ideas people have that will weaken us in the struggle for power. So these are suicidal ideas. We should get rid of them. Now, this, as I say, we're going to be talking next week about the neocons, who in some respects had strong ties to the National Review Conservatives, but this emphasis on power rather than ideas is a crucial difference of Burnham from the neocons. And another difference is kind of a more general difference, power versus ideas. Another difference from the neocons in Burnham is that Burnham tended to be, in considering the Middle East, he tended to be pro-Arab and anti-Israel, in large part because of the importance of oil from the Middle East for America. As we'll see in the next few lectures, the neocons are very pro-Israel. That's one of the most important views of theirs. So that would be one strong difference between the neocons and Burnham. Now, the other things I want to discuss in the time we have left is Wilmore Kendall, who lived from 1909 to 1967. I think the Wikipedia has Kendall's death date as 1968, but I believe 67 is the correct date. I think he had a heart attack and died in his sleep. He was someone who influenced Buckley very much because when Buckley attended Yale University, he was one of Buckley's teachers and they became very good friends. Now, what Kendall, one of his main themes was he thought that liberalism, the contemporary American left, had the view that certain people were so-called experts or intellectuals who were really should be the ruling class, even though we have an ostensible democracy. Really, American liberals thought people were unenlightened and they needed to be guided by experts. And so Kendall was opposed to this. And here we can see a contrast with Burnham, because Burnham is saying, well, we have this new managerial elite. It was going to be the ruling class. And Kendall is saying, look, this is no good. We shouldn't have these experts who are ruling over this. So this was really a strong difference between Kendall and Burnham. And an example of the difference between the liberal experts and the American people is that at the time Kendall was writing, the liberals tend to be very tolerant of communists and other radicals. They would say, well, the Soviet sympathizers are going too far, but after all, they have some good ideas and we shouldn't really try to suppress them or get rid of them. They have a right of free speech, but common people tended to be very anti-communist, saying, let's root all these communists out. Civil liberties aren't so important. And Kendall held that the common people believed in a public orthodoxy, just like, say, if you're a member of a certain religion, say you're a Catholic or a Jew or a Protestant, you have certain views that you have to hold if you're in that particular religion. So Kendall said, well, the American people think that there's an American orthodoxy. People really have to subscribe to certain principles in order to be good Americans. You can't say, well, I want to be a communist and still be an American. You don't. This goes against the public orthodoxy. Now, those such as the liberals that Kendall opposed, who said that we shouldn't have a public orthodoxy, very often appeal to the arguments in John Stuart Mill's famous essay on liberty, which came out in 1859. Incidentally, the title of Mill's essay is On Liberty. It's not Essay on Liberty. Essay isn't in the title. It is an essay about liberty, but essay isn't in the title. So what Mill said, one of the arguments Mill gives in that famous book, he said that if you have free speech, then you'll have ideas in competition with each other. And just like, say, in a free market, you have competition among different products, and the product the consumers want the most will come to prevail. Mill thought that if you have ideas exposed to attack, this will be a way of producing truth. And even if you have, say, very bad ideas, ones that you hate, it's still a good idea to keep these, not try to suppress these ideas, because if you hate the ideas, maybe they'll come up, the people who favor them will come up with some points that will enable you to refine your own ideas. And besides, if you always have to be prepared to meet objections, this will enable you to hold your ideas in a living way instead of just as dead dogmas. So Kendall thought Mill was all wrong, or at least a great deal of it was wrong. He said, well, look at science, which after all is a very good way of generating truth. Scientists are very good at coming up with truth, but scientists don't just take seriously anyone who comes along. Say, suppose I said, well, I've got this new theory, Einstein was all wrong, I've got these new equations that show we have a completely new way of explaining the universe. No one would pay attention to me because I have no qualifications in physics. Scientists will only pay attention to people who are qualified, not to everybody. So Kendall was saying Mill's arguments for free speech are really not, in On Liberty, are really not very good. So supposing Kendall was right, that there is a public orthodoxy in America that's intolerant, just as Kendall suggests, why should we go along with what this orthodoxy mandates? Now, suppose even that Kendall is right in questioning Mill. Mill said we shouldn't have this public orthodoxy, we shouldn't have open debate. Supposing, I don't think Kendall is right in this, but I'm supposing Kendall really knocked out Mill's arguments. I don't think he did, but supposing he did, that doesn't show we have to have a public orthodoxy. But so why should we have it? Well, Kendall really was a follower of the great 18th century French political philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. In particular, he accepted Rousseau's idea of a general will, which is found in his famous book, The Social Contract. And as it happened, Kendall did an English translation of The Social Contract. Many people associate Rousseau with the left, and there was a tradition in American conservatism being very anti-Rousseau, but Kendall was very sympathetic to Rousseau. And what the notion of the general will was that if the people in society deliberate, if people start talking among themselves, then special interests will tend to cancel out, and the results of the deliberation are likely to be true. So instead of deciding questions by going to people who are supposed to be experts, what you would do is have people deliberate among themselves, have the common people deliberate, and if they did that over a prolonged period, then according to Rousseau and Kendall, they'd be likely to come up with good policies. Now, the fact that Kendall believed in the general will did not make him a majority rule Democrat. You might think that, well, if you think that people should settle things by popular deliberation, wouldn't that mean the majority rules? Isn't that what popular deliberation is? But Kendall didn't view it that way. He said, and this is a characteristic phrase, he said, we have to consult a deliberate sense of the community, the American community. And this required more than a bare majority in a presidential election. Was voting, of course, he died in 67, but supposing he were looking at things today, say the fact that people voted for Obama in 2008 wouldn't show that the general will is favoring Obama. He thought that you really get the general will by looking at what people are deciding in their local communities, voting for their particular member of Congress. Thought that would really be more of an expression of the deliberate sense of the American community, not majority in a presidential election. He tended to be more sympathetic to Congress than to the executive. He said, if you want real American conservatism, you're going to find it in Congress rather than the president. Now, in your reading selection, I put a memo that Murray Rothbard wrote after attending some lectures that Kendall was giving. These lectures were later published by his student, George Carey, and revised a book called The Basic Symbols of the American Political Tradition. So Rothbard offers what I can think is a really devastating criticism of Kendall's belief in the wisdom of the community. Now, Rothbard asked, well, if you're talking about the wisdom of the community, then wouldn't Kendall have to side with the Athenian assembly who sentenced Socrates to death rather than with Socrates? And wouldn't he have to side with the mob against Jesus? Remember, Kendall was actually a devout Catholic, so that would be a pretty embarrassing thing for him if he would have to settle with the mob against Jesus. And Kendall, I don't think he's directly replied to Rothbard, but he admitted that he would have sided against Socrates. I don't think he said he would have sided against Jesus. That would have gotten him into trouble with the church. But he admitted he would have to support the Athenian assembly against Socrates. Incidentally, can anybody tell me what were Socrates' last words? Does anybody know that? Last words were, I drank the what? Yes, that's right, Jeff has it. I drank the what? That's it. Yes, good one. Yes, here. So, given his stress on the community, the general will, Kendall tended to be very suspicious of individual rights. Say, he wouldn't like libertarians who say, we support each person having the right of self-ownership. In fact, he was aware of Rothbard. He didn't write much on him. I don't think he wrote on Rothbard. He was certainly aware of libertarianism. He said something like one of his articles said, he swore no unyielding oath of fealty to the free market, a la Ludwig von Mises. I think that's pretty much a direct quotation. So it's, for him, it's the deliberative community, deliberate sense of the American people that's important, not the rights of individuals considered apart from one another. Now, people like Rothbard, who believe in individual rights, very often appeal to John Locke in the Second Treatise on Government. Locke talks about self-ownership and property rights. But Kendall had an unusual way of looking at Locke, and he actually wrote his PhD dissertation on John Locke, John Locke and Doctrine of Majority Rule. He thought that Locke was not someone who supported individual rights, but he interpreted Locke to be a majority rule Democrat. He kind of disregarded the passages where Locke is talking, or de-emphasized passages where Locke's talking about self-ownership, and he stressed more that when people get together, they agree to form a society, and they have a supplementary contract where they agree to be ruled by majority. So he took this kind of more of a taking Locke to be a majority rule Democrat. Now, Kendall was very influential in the early years of National Review, but after a few years, he quit the magazine, then he quarreled with Buckley. And in part, the reason for this was personal. As it turned out, he had a very cantankerous personality. I think someone said about him, I think Dwight MacDonald, the famous American political and literary critic, who was also, again, he had been a Trotskyite at one time in the 30s, and he'd been an associate of James Burns. I should mention before, Kendall himself, for a while in the 30s, had also been a Trotskyite, but for a brief period. So MacDonald said about Kendall something like, he can get an argument to the shouting stage faster than anyone I've ever met. So Kendall had a kind of cantankerous personality. But there was a serious issue at stake in his split with National Review. He thought that National Review had become too elitist. Remember, he's stressing more the common people, the deliberate sense of the American community. And he said, well, if you look at the abstractions that you'll find in Burnham or in Russell Kirk, who was another writer for National Review, he said, the American people wouldn't die for these abstractions. This isn't something they fight on the beaches for. And instead of being concerned with these abstract theories, you should appeal to the common beliefs of the American people. So he thought National Review wasn't doing that, and that's the one meaning that he split with them. Okay, well, I think I'll stop now, and we can now have questions and discussion for the rest of the time. So just type into the chat anything you'd like to talk about. Well, I'll tell you, while we're waiting for questions, a funny story I heard about Burnham. See, as I mentioned, Buckley was very influenced by him. So Buckley would sometimes call Burnham at Burnham's house and want to discuss what was going on on the magazine, or ask him for advice on various points. So as soon as Buckley would call, Burnham would start the clock, because he would charge Buckley for the phone conversation. So Buckley would have to pay for all the advice Burnham gave him over the phone. Molly, do we have any, somebody have any comments, questions? Anything else you'd like to talk about? We have about another 25 minutes left. Oh, here's something. Andy says, what was the relationship between Kendall and Brim? They both worked for NR at the same time. Right. And, I mean, Kendall was there for a much briefer time than Brim. I don't think they got along very well. They didn't engage in, say, as massive a fight as, say, Kendall and Russell Kirk, but they didn't get along. You see, Burnham, in spite of his youthful Trotskyism, was a very upper-class person. He had came from a very wealthy family. He was been to Princeton, Oxford. And while Kendall also had these very high academic connections, he'd been studied at Oxford under R.G. Collingwood, the great philosopher and historian. And he was professor at Yale. He was a very unruly person. He had a very bad temper. He was a womanizer. He was also an alcoholic. So I think Burnham looked at him with disdain, and he kind of thought, oh, well, this is just some kind of wild person. And they were both wanted to have influence on Buckley, and Burnham was pretty good at getting rid of people who were rivals to influence Buckley, just as he thought that history was a kind of a struggle for power. He viewed his tenure at the magazine as some kind of a struggle for power, and he wanted to be in charge, and he remained, while he was in charge, a dominant figure in the magazine. Of course, Buckley got much more public attention than Burnham, but I mean, Burnham was the main person formulating foreign policy. Now, let's see. Andrew says, maybe we're going to the next week, but I'm interested in the role of National Review in trying to define what conservatism is or should be. How did Buckley handle competing influences like these two and others? Well, what he did, Buckley didn't try to impose a line on the various writers. He recognized there were these differences, but what he was trying to do was make sure that the old right view of saying we shouldn't get involved in these foreign wars or we shouldn't have an aggressive Cold War policy, that this was cast aside. If you were willing to support a strong Cold War policy, at least if you didn't oppose it, then Buckley was pretty content to let you write for the magazine. Although there were groups, it would be only a partial exception because the objectivists tended to support the Cold War also, although Ayn Rand had been an opponent of American entry into World War II. He was not sympathetic to Ayn Rand and her group. Remember, Buckley was a devout Catholic, and the objectionists were very strongly atheists, so that was a big point against her, and he published a lot of critical articles about her. There weren't any objectivists who were strongly associated with National Guru. There were some people who were atheists, like the writer Max Eastman, but he wasn't such a major person. So basically, the key thing, if you want to be on good terms with National Guru, is you have to support the Cold War. If you, but Buckley didn't try to say, well, you have to believe in such and such policy. You say, there's this tension between the theories of Buckley and Burnham and Kendall. Burnham is, someone said, we have to have a technological elite or managerial elite. Kendall says, no, it's an American community that should be ruling. So there is that tension. I mean, Buckley didn't rule out Frank Meyer's point of view, which is we can have some kind of minimal statism but still have an extremely aggressive foreign policy. So as long as you're really willing to support the Cold War, then you're all right with Buckley. And he said there was a time that when NR was just about the only respectable voice, and I'm interested in what NR said it was. Yes, I think that's right. There weren't too many right-wing magazines. I mean, there were others, like the Modern Age, but that was really supported by the same people who were supporting Buckley. And National Review did attract a lot of writers, people were interesting writers, especially in the late 50s, early 60s. You have much more interesting people than write for the magazine today, like Eric von Kuhnelt-Dean used to write for them. Now here's one. Charles says, Cold War strategist George Kennan is known as the Five of Containment, and James Burnham, the father of the liberation, rolled back to Soviet. There wasn't Kennan really more sympathetic to old PC covert action, secret underground armies, or overt CIA propaganda, is usually portrayed. Hasn't there really been a false dichotomy between them? That's an excellent point. Well, I think you're quite right that Kennan supported all these CIA measures. He was one of the main people, I think, when it looked like the Italian Communist Party was going to do well, I think, in the elections in the late 1940s, he was supporting various efforts by CIA to make sure they didn't win. But you see, the difference is, well, what kind of CIA, what was the base of operations for the CIA? The basic aim was to make sure that the communists didn't expand any further. But Burnham and the rollback people were more aggressive. They weren't saying, well, that's not just, we don't want to just have CIA operations disrupt the communists. We want to get rid of them altogether. And Kennan's point of view was more, well, if we can stop them, then eventually the Soviet system is not going to be able to survive, and it will just cease to exist if we can wait them out. So I think there is that difference. But you're right, I mean, one can overstress the dichotomy between Kennan and his opponents, but I think it is there. Now, one aspect there that Kennan's interesting is in his later years, Kennan tends to be quite critical of a lot of the Cold War policies. He intended to play down his own role in formulating Cold War policies. He tended to picture himself and said, well, something like, I never intended containment as that militaristic an idea, it was just kind of a moderate idea, but it was a fairly aggressive policy when he formulated. I think he tended to downplay that in his later years. He lived an enormously long time. I think he lived to be about 101 years old. Now, just as Rothko pointed out, the importance of Morgan and Rothko groups in U.S. policy, late 19th, early 20th century. Is it possible the CIA now is a kingmaking role in U.S. politics since World War II? Well, I think that that's possible. I don't have any real data to really to show that. I mean, it's certainly one of the possibilities. Of course, when Rothko was writing, we had this was he was writing after these events had happened, so we had a lot of source material to rely on. But I think we can certainly say the CIA is a very influential body in American politics. But to establish that they have a kingmaker role, I think would require a lot of documentation. And there's one writer, Peter Dale Scott, who's written a lot on the CIA, I think is interesting, who stresses their influence. But you know, I think this is sort of one subject worthy of a lot of investigation, but you know, I don't have anything major revelations on that myself. Jeff says, Jeff says, Bushes and Buckley are off Skull and Bones. What does it mean? Well, the Skull and Bones Society is kind of in Yale, they have various social groups. And the Skull and Bones, I think, is considered the most prestigious one. It's kind of a secret society. Now, there was a writer named Anthony Sutton who argue the Skull and Bone is kind of a secret American government because a lot of people in Skull and Bones tend to be very influential. But I tend to think he wasn't really able to establish that. I mean, you would expect, since Yale is one of the elite institutions, people who go to that university and are admitted to and the exclusive social group would tend to be very influential. And people in that society seem very attached to their group, but you know, I don't think Sutton's able to show they have some particular ideology that they're trying to promote. But I mean, it is interesting to know that a lot of people have been, influential people have been in that group. Let's see, Andy says, are you going to go to PaleoCon's in next class? Are they the antithesis of neocons? Yet I'm not going to discuss the Paleos all that much. I probably mention them a little bit. But they did view themselves very much as the opponents of the neocons. They thought the neocons that really were not true conservatives, and they regarded themselves as true conservatives. Paleo means old conservatives as opposed to new ones. Remember, like the great French Catholic writer Jacques Maritain said, I'm not a neo-Thomist, I'm a paleo-Thomist. So this was something that paleos, I knew some of them because Murray Rothbard was for a time allied with them. We'd have people like Sam Francis, Mel Bradford, Paul Gottfried, who's still around. I know him very well. So we have the paleos. Tom Fleming of Chronicles magazine was an influential paleo. Pat Buchanan, some of them are more favorable to the free market than others, but they were all very interesting personalities and all strongly opposed to the neocons. I'm just out of curiosity, has anyone in the class read Burnham or Kendall before I mention them? Well, let me see, there's one question. Matthew says, a little off topic, were the views of Democrats versus Republicans always quite close as they are now, or in the past, was there a larger divergence? Well, I think at some points there was quite a divergence. For example, at the time Rothbard was writing about, when he talked about the old right, there were certain sections of the Republicans that were extremely opposed to the New Deal and to Franklin Roosevelt. So there were, I think, at least at that time, Republicans and Democrats tended to be very far apart. I mean, there were Southern Democrats who were not that left-wing at one time. But say, if you look in the 1930s and 1940s, I think at least some of the Republicans were quite far from the Democrats. Oh, Jeff says you haven't read Kendall or Burnham. Well, they're very much interesting writers. I think they're both. Rothbard, as you'll see if you read his criticism of Kendall, he disagreed very strongly with Kendall, but he had some respect for him. He thought he was raised some fundamental points. I think he would probably view Burnham as a more sinister figure. Incidentally, Harry Elmer Barnes was one who took a very negative view of Burnham. He thought that Orwell's 1984 was designed in part as a reply to Burnham and kind of intended as somewhat of a satirical portrayal of Burnham's book. And Rothbard held that view of 1984 as well. Let's see here, something else, the way it's set here. Charles says, I love Burnham's Machiavelli and recommend to others with the qualification George Orwell pointed out concerning Burnham's skewed projection. Well, it's a very well written book. You can certainly learn a lot about Machiavelli and Pareto and Mosca, Sorel. I remember I read that book in around 1971 when I was getting ready for my PhD, or else I found it very helpful. I think he's too negative on Dante, but I think it is a very useful book to read. You're quite right. Andy said, didn't Burnham predict the state of affairs today pretty well? Well, to a certain extent he did, although I think he was wrong in thinking this kind of an inevitable development. But I mean, it was something that sort of this people had tried to bring about, this system of kind of a somewhat fascist type of state. It's been extremely influential. I think it's come about more because people's ideas rather than the inevitable trend of history, as Burnham thought. Burnham got into trouble later on National Review with some of the readers because he liked Robert McNamara, the Secretary of State Secretary of Defense under Kennedy. He was kind of a technocrat, and he wrote an article favoring him, and he wasn't such a big fan of Barry Goldwater. He liked Nelson Rockefeller, so a lot of people who liked some of the readers of National Review didn't care for that, those ideas. Now, Charles says he strongly disliked Burnham's Suicide of the West, a very flawed book in many respects. Now, that's interesting. And what would you think are the main problems with the book? And I remember when there was a scandal, I think, that when it was revealed that the CIA was supporting British magazine Encounter, and Burnham's reaction to that was, well, somebody broke security, didn't think there was anything wrong with the CIA supporting magazine. It's just, isn't it a shame somebody revealed this, somebody broke the security. So I think he tended to view himself as a CIA person. Charles said, his stereotypical liberal, he had a quiz one should take to determine your political profile. I came out as a moderate. I'd been a radical Rothbardian for 40 years, anything but a moderate. Yeah, I remember he had this sort of a catechism. There were about 36 or so things you had to check them off as true or false. That one was, torture is justified in some circumstances or something, and that would determine what you, I mean, that's toward the front of the book, as I remember. That brings back memories. I remember reading that book when it came out in 64. So let's see here something. A.L. says, I think all that talk raises opposition to Ron Paul is misunderstood. He's too much of a constitutionalist for today's conservatives. That's a good point, I think, because he doesn't want to, Ron Paul doesn't favor this kind of very aggressive foreign policy. I think a lot of people, the talk radios, do oppose him. Well, I guess, does anyone have a last question? We're about out of time now. If anyone has a last comment or question. Well, all right, everybody. Thanks very much for coming to the lecture. Oh, wait, there's something here. Wait one sec here. When Burnham died, the Special National Review had all these obituary tributes from the CIA time. And officials. Well, I hadn't remembered that. That's a very good point. But I mean, I think he maintained a lot of ties to the CIA. He was certainly, I'm sure he was one of them till the end. Okay, well, thanks everybody. So we'll see you all next week, I hope. Thanks a lot. Bye, everybody. Thank you.